Hello everyone, welcome to the second season of the series of podcasts with IEEE Electron Devices Society Luminaries. As the world's largest professional organization, IEEE plays a significant role to enhance the quality of our life. Electron Devices Society, or EDS, encompasses activities involving electron devices, the main enabler for today's digital world. I'm Muhammad Mustafa Hussain, a professor of Elmore Family School of Electrical and Computer Engineering of Purdue University. I play a variety of roles in different capacities within the Electron Devices Society of IEEE. In this series of podcasts, we will be interviewing those EDS members who have made remarkable impacts in our society through their innovations and dedication. Our guest today is recognized with an Emmy Award, membership to the United States National Academy of Engineering, an IEEE Eldard Van Der Ziel Award, IEEE Masaru Ibuka Consumer Electronics Award, IEEE Electron Devices Society J.J. Eberts Award for his pioneering contributions to the camera technology for consumer electronic applications. Yes. We are speaking with Professor Marvin White of Ohio State University. Dr. Marvin White is a professor in the Electrical and Computer Engineering Department at Ohio State University and Sharman Fairchild Professor Emeritus of Electrical Engineering at Lehigh University. After receiving a BSE degrees in engineering physics and mathematics, and master's degree in physics from the University of Michigan, he worked 20 years at the Westinghouse Defense and Space Center in Baltimore, Maryland, moving from associate to advisory engineer, where he designed advanced integrated circuits for radar, sonar, communication, and imaging systems. In particular, he and his colleagues developed correlated double sampling, CDS, to suppress noise in imaging systems. While at Westinghouse, he took a leave of absence and received a PhD in electrical engineering at Ohio State University under Merlin O. Thurston. In 1978-79, he taught in Belgium under a senior Fulbright fellowship. He taught courses in solid-state electronics in the Westinghouse School of Applied Science from 1962 to 1966. And an adjunct professor of electrical engineering at the University of Maryland from 1972 to 1978. In 1981, he joined the Electrical and Computer Engineering Department at Lehigh University as the Sherman Fairchild Professor in Electrical Engineering in the Sherman Fairchild Center for Solid State Studies. In 1986, he was a visiting research scientist at NRL, and in 1995 to 1996, he served as program director at National Science Foundation. In 1998, he became director of the Sherman Fairchild Center. His research is in custom integrated circuits, analog, digital, and radio frequency, or RF, signal processing, solid-state imaging, sensors, Sonos, non-volatile memories, CMOS transistors, MEMS, and BioMEMS, and silicon carbide power devices. He has graduated 37 PhDs and 65 master's students. His teaching areas are analysis and design of integrated circuits, advanced sensors, and physics of semiconductor devices. In the years he has been in industry and the university, Dr. White has over 300 papers with colleagues and students with 28 US patents. Some of the honors and awards that he has received: 2021, Emmy Award for correlated double sampling for image sensors in the 73rd Annual Technology and Engineering Emmy Awards, National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences, 2019 International Image Sensor Society Pioneering Achievement Award for Development of the Correlated Double Sampling, CDS, Noise Reduction Technique for Image Sensors. 2011 Ohio State University College of Engineering Distinguished Alumnus Award. 2010 IEEE Electron Devices Society Distinguished Service Award to recognize and honor outstanding service to the Electron Devices Society. In 2001, he was elected to National Academy of Engineering for contributions to solid state imagers and for advances in silicon devices and technology. In 2001, he received IEEE Eldred van der Ziel Award for distinguished education and research contributions to the field of electronic devices and materials. In 2000, he received IEEE Masaru Ibuka Consumer Electronics Award for pioneering and innovative contributions to the development of low light level solid state imagers used in consumer products. In 1997, he received the IEEE Electron Devices Society J.J. Eberts Award for pioneering contributions to the development of high sensitivity solid state cameras and imagers widely used in consumer and technical applications and for his major contributions to progress in semiconductor devices. His other recognitions include 1997 Lehigh University's Eleanor and Joseph F. Lipsch Research Award, 1982 IEEE Electron Devices Society Distinguished Lecturer in Solid State VLSI Devices, 1975 Westinghouse and NASA Distinguished Patent Awards, 1974 he was elected as IEEE Fellow for contributions to the theory and development of electron devices, especially memory transistors and charge couple imaging arrays. 1974, Washington Academy of Science Fellow Award. How are you doing today?
Good.
Very well. I will go ahead and we'll start from the beginning, and that starts with your childhood. If you can kindly share some of your fond memories with your childhood, your school life. Please go ahead.
Well, I was born in the 1930s, near the tail end of what we call the Great Depression. My father lost his job. And my mother, when she was carrying me, lost her job because she couldn't stay working and still be pregnant. So it was a difficult time. And later in the 1940s, my father found a job guarding Jeeps that were going to be sent over for the invasion of Normandy. These Jeeps were to go to London. So he was guarding the Jeeps, and I was starting to go to school at that time. I remember listening to Franklin Delano Roosevelt's fireside chats at night, telling all of the people in the United States about the war at that time. The war was commencing earlier in 1941. And I do remember going to school at that time. And it was a difficult time, actually. And then when the war ended in 1945, my father lost his job again because he didn't have to guard any of the Jeeps at that time. So since it was the Jeeps were in the Ford Motor Company near Chester, Pennsylvania, so he decided to go up to Michigan because the Ford Motor Company had a plant up there, and he went up there and he became a plant protection person up there in the Ford plant. And I started to, I continued going to school up there. I was around the fourth or fifth grade at that time when we moved up there. And I do remember trying to make a little bit of money when I was young. I would do a lot of different things like go out and shine shoes and go around to restaurants and bars and make some money. So I remember doing that. We didn't have a lot of money at that time. And so we lived in an apartment for a while, and then we saved up enough money and was able to buy a house. Most of the people were coming back from World War II, at that time, and many of them were on the GI Bill. Now, my father was older. He was born in Canada in 1982, so he was in his late 40s. My mother was born in 1902. She was an orphan in New York, and she was in St. Agnes School for the Girls. And anyway, she was 10 years younger than my dad. And so basically, we got a house, and then at that time started going to school. I can remember a few things. I had a lot of jobs, basically, as a young guy. I set pins in the bowling alley. I worked in a TV repair shop, worked in a machine shop, running a lathe and a shaper. A lot of different jobs, stock boy, paper boy. So I did a lot of work like that as a young guy. And in high school, I really did like math and science, and particularly physics and chemistry. So that was a very good time for me in terms of trying to focus on what I wanted to do. I joined the Civil Air Patrol, which was relatively new at that time. It was a division of the United States Air Force. So later when I went to college, I joined up for the Air Force ROTC program. I don't think at that time the programs in the ROTC paid your way through school. Can't remember much, but I didn't stay very long in the program. Anyway, that was probably pretty much my childhood. I can't think of anything else. I think in going through high school, I felt that several teachers made an impact on me. My geometry teacher wanted me to teach a class one day, student teaching, and I thought that was very good. I never did anything like that before, and he suggested that I work with him on the talk, so it was very good. I enjoyed getting up before the class, a little scared of a little bit to begin with. Never did I realize I'd be teaching as a professor later on. My chemistry teacher encouraged me to do experiments in the summer and learn more about the halogens. So I worked on that. The physics teacher was great. He gave difficult college level problems, and I like to work on these kinds of problems. So I'm trying to just remember back on things that influenced me growing up and going through high school. My father worked at Forge, as I mentioned, and they were constantly going on strike. And a lot of times we were at home and didn't have money to pay for the heating in the house, and the windows would freeze up. I do remember that growing up. And my mother was really a great force in my life. She wanted me to go to college because when she was working in New York, she worked for a person that went to college, and she thought that that was the secret to success in life. So she wanted me to be a dentist. So I sort of decided not to do that. And I went into engineering. I had no role model for that, but I liked the idea of building things. And so I went into engineering and went on to a community college locally, because I didn't have enough money to go anywhere else and I could live at home. And it was the Henry Ford Community College, and had great teachers there in math and physics and chemistry. So at the end of that 2 years of community college, I got a scholarship to go to the University of Michigan at that time. And I decided to go into a new program there. It was called Engineering Physics, and it allowed you to take physics and math and electrical engineering and oh, many things, astronomy, languages. So it was a very flexible program, not like today where we have more of a structured program in many of the engineering fields. So I enjoyed my time up there. I played a lot of sports. I had a brother, and he's 6 years younger than me. So I had to hurry home from high school to take care of him while my mother went back to work as a secretary. And so I took care of him after school, but in the summertime, I could play baseball. And when I went to the University of Michigan, I played a lot of sports there. These called intramural sports. And so I learned how to play soccer. When I went to the University of Michigan, I decided to live in a co-op house. A co-op house is where you meet people from different countries. And I had a chance to meet people from many places in the world. And a co-op house is one where you work about 4 or 5 hours a week, and you basically clean the floors, wash the dishes. And I decided that I'd rather cook. So I decided to cook, and I wound up cooking on Sundays, the only meal that the people had in the house. We had about 40 people, and there were no women there at the time. It was all men in the house. Now, if you go back, the co-op house, which was named after Robert Owen, a socialist. And the co-ops were actually started in the 1930s in the Depression. And they were about, I would say about $125 a semester to live there. And you basically planned your own meals. I was a steward for a while and a president of the house. And it was very good to learn how to get along with a lot of people, to learn how to balance the budget. It was an interesting time. The co-op cost about $125 a semester, but also school was only $125 a semester. So you could work in the summertime and make enough money to pay your way through school. I don't think that's even close to being possible today with the expenses and the way costs run at a university. And so that's the most difficult thing, I think, for young people to take out the loans that they're doing and pay for them. So I never had to do that. I mean, I always could make enough money to do that. And I was close to home. So it worked out pretty good. Then, you know, when I took engineering physics, and near the end of my 4 years, and I was 2 years in the community college and 2 years up there at the University of Michigan. Near the end of the time, I took a course, I believe from Don Mason. He was in the chemical and metallurgical department. It was a new course on transistors. And, you know, transistors were out for almost a decade, but it took a long time to get courses to come to the universities. So I heard that this was a very interesting course because I had worked on vacuum tubes all the time going to Michigan. All my labs were on vacuum tube and vacuum tube design. But the transistor was an interesting course, involved a lot of physics of operation. And I learned a lot about scattering processes of carriers, which you don't really have in to a large extent in vacuum tubes. And it was just really an eye-opener to take this course. And as I went into graduate school in physics at Michigan, I had the feeling that I really liked the electronic aspect. And that's what I wanted to do. Although most of the work that I worked on at the University of Michigan was in the high energy area, especially pion muon decay. And this is an area of research that I could get some funding for while I was a master's student at the university. And we had a fellow named Don Glaser there. He won the Nobel Prize in bubble chamber work. So we did some work, myself and another person. And at the end of the master's degree, I think we both, the fellow next to me and me, we just decided, hey, you know, maybe we ought to go out and get some experience and work a little bit. So we started interviewing, and that's when I worked all the time during the summertime. I worked in the Willow Run facility up there. That's the place where they built the bombers at Willow Run. And I worked out there. And I met a lot of great people out there doing research while I was a graduate student. So then I decided that I'd go out and try to get a job. And I mentioned I had a lot of jobs growing up, but I got a job offer from Westinghouse. And Westinghouse had a research lab in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and they had facilities all over the United States. And the one facility that hired a lot of electrical engineers was down in Baltimore. It was the Defense Center down there. So what happened is, it's interesting. When we got an offer from Westinghouse, myself and another person, we basically joined what's called a graduate student program. So at that time, what you did was you went through different parts of the company for 4 to 6 week assignments. And then you see if you could find a position at the company that would be compatible with your interests and with the job opening that was present at that location. But there were about 450 of us at that time that were going through the graduate student program. And I'll tell you, we were going through for some period of time taking different jobs. There were just no job openings. And this would be in 1960, 61, in that time frame. So it was getting difficult to actually find an opening, even though we liked the jobs. And one job I took, I was down in Baltimore, and I went to a laboratory called the Solid State Laboratory. It was fairly new, and they were working on things called molecular electronics. Now, you'll probably laugh about that, but at that time, there was a professor at MIT, von Hippel, and he decided that the new devices were going to be made of spins, fields, charges, and waves, nothing that resembled resistors, capacitors, transistors, so on. So we were trying to do this, and we had a program with the Air Force to work on these kinds of new devices. And that was my first assignment down there. I really liked it. But the person that ran the lab said, you know, we don't really have a job opening. So I said, okay. So I took another job position up in the research labs in Pittsburgh and worked a while up there. And then after that assignment, there was no opening up there either, especially for people with just master's degrees. And so I decided to look around, and they said there's another position that's available down in the Westinghouse lab that you worked in before in Baltimore. I said, okay, I'll be glad to go down. And they said that there's a new laboratory opening up down there. It's called the Physics Laboratory, Applied Physics. And they're working on Schrodinger's equation, artificial wells. And I said, well, that's great. That's what I studied in physics, but all about Schrodinger's equation. So I said, I'm going to go down there and get an assignment in that lab. So I went down to the lab, and I walked into this room where I was supposed to meet my manager of the lab, and he was there. But also my manager from the first assignment was there too. And the person that was running the program down in the Baltimore area said, you know, you had an assignment down here before with Dr. Stroll in the Solid State Laboratory, and he would like you to come back for a second assignment. And I said, yeah, I said, this sounds interesting. But he says, there's really not a job opening in that laboratory. And I thought for a bit, and I said, you know, I like the work so much, I think I'll take the job down there, because I thought if you do a good job, you know, something good will happen, and I like the work. So I never did get to work in the applied physics lab, but I went back into the laboratory that I started working with down there in the first assignment. And it turns out that a couple of people left before the end of the of my assignment. And they left to go down to North Carolina because there was a rumor that the governor down there wanted to start the Research Triangle Institute. You've heard about that. That's where SRC is, Semiconductor Research Corporation. But it didn't get started for several years, but they went down very early and began to work in that area. And it opened up positions in the lab. So that was my first real job then, was to work at Westinghouse. And they call it Defense and Space Division, that was located in the Baltimore area. So that's pretty much my growing up and my graduate school and my going to my first job, which started around 1961. So that's it.
You know, it's such a fascinating and authentic, you know, the walk in the memory lane. You were born pretty much, you know, my dad, who was a physician himself, a pediatrician, he was also born pretty much in the, you know, the late 30s. And, you know, that when you were describing during your childhood that the experiences that you had with the war going on, and then like you know the you actually had couple you participated in kind of interesting like you know the jobs, I would say, like a variety of those. They helped you to hone your engineering skill going forward, right? Like you know the fixing the radios to like you know the to do like you know working as a paperboy and many other things. Especially you know the having the life's perspective. You volunteered in a co-op. You lived there and like you know the budget milling, like you know all those kind of things. It's actually like you know the many people I can tell you because. You know, that we are pretty much, this is my 30th interview with, like, you know, in this series. This is going to be a really, really fascinating, very authentic story about, like, you know, your upbringing and the society at that point and the opportunities they were there and also the limitations. Thank you so much for sharing that. I would like to actually go and ask you about, like, you know, your work, which eventually, like you know, contributed globally, which made you today's Marvin White. Let's talk about your contributions, your seminal contributions at a pioneering level to the image processor, and then their, you know, I would say the technological transfer. In the consumer electronics space, right? You might have like you know the very interesting memories associated with that, and also from that perspective, you know that what was your real eureka moment if you had one, right? Like you know, let's talk about that. You know your work on in the area of the image processor and image sensing.
Well, I had many. Types of work, I would say, which was really quite an advantage. When you go to industry, for example, if you go in as a PhD, I could see that you tended to be not work so much on teams at the time I went in. It may be different now, but it was something that kind of isolated you from where when I went down to where the electrical engineering hiring was going on. In other words, if you look at the composition, when I went in, there were very few PhDs working there, mostly bachelor's and master's degrees. So I fit in quite well working down there. I was not, I like to work on the team basis because I felt that the aspects of getting something done required the skills of so many people. And it was great to get on the board and work in a group and write things down and have people argue. And then you get their viewpoints. And that was really something that I liked all along. I liked the idea of communication with people. And so I enjoyed it. And I think it was really good to go in without a PhD degree into that environment. So I want to mention that. And now the other thing is that so many things I worked on in my career, it was just not one particular thing. And it is surprising to me, the one thing that I did work on for such a really short period of time in industry was the thing that turned out 50 years later to be the thing that I've been recognized for. So that is something that is quite interesting to me. I've always felt that there are other things that, you know, would have been more interesting. But one of the first things I started to work on was the area of imaging. As you realize, in the 60s, we were in the Cold War in the United States, and there was a lot of emphasis placed on different types of imaging, particularly infrared imaging in the night vision laboratories of the government. And so they were always interested in getting improved sensitivity in infrared cameras. So I started to work on things that were related to semiconductor materials that could detect infrared radiation. And so one of the areas I worked on was that the idea of taking materials like indium antimonide or indium arsenide, things that could sense the near infrared region, and place them in a vacuum tube and scan them with an electron beam. And basically like a checkerboard pattern in a vacuum tube. And it just, and the idea was that we would try to make PN junctions, and that these junctions would be reverse biased by the electron beam. So the idea is that if you look at the early image tubes that were used, the image orthicon and the vidicon, basically these were tubes that had a photoconducting layer that was deposited over the faceplate. And it was like maybe 10 microns thick or something like that. And it may be even a little thinner than that. And the way you can look at these layers is that they were uniform in the image orthicon and the vidicon. They were uniform and they had a certain thickness, T. And the beam would sweep over the surface, and the beam has a certain diameter, let's say A. So let's say it was a 10 micron diameter even, or maybe less. So as the beam swept over the surface, in like say the vidicon, it would try to bring the surface down to the cathode potential, close to ground. And let's say the other plate of the photoconductive layer is held at some positive voltage, has some conductive layer on that. And that would allow the image to come through. So now you can think of the area under the beam as being made up out of a capacitor and a resistance of the material, an RC time constant. Now you can calculate the capacitance, which would be the dielectric constant over the thickness of the layer and times the area of the beam. And the resistance would be the resistivity times the thickness of the material divided by the beam diameter. So if you multiply the RC time constant, R times C, you get the dielectric constant of the material times the resistivity. And you try to make that large so that when the beam is scanning like that, and if there's no image on it, no light coming in to create electron hole pairs in the material to change the resistance, then the beam wouldn't have to supply any electrons to charge up the surface to ground, the cathode potential. But then as light would come in at different points over here, it would discharge the surface, change the resistance, and the beam would have to supply the necessary charge. And this is the principle then of storage. You basically would store the photon flux coming in over a time frame that the beam would take to scan. So the idea was to replace this photoconductive surface over there with little squares of reverse bias diodes. So I chose to do like indium antimonide for far, I would call it the more or less what we call the near infrared, but it does go out to about 5 microns or so. So anyway, I worked on that for a while for the night vision laboratory, got a renewal. That's the whole thing in industry, get your renewal. And later the project manager at the night vision labs, he said to me, at one of the classified conferences called IRIS, Infrared Imaging Systems Conference. He said to me, you know, Marvin, he said, I gave you the renewal, he said, to this contract that you were working on. But he says, you know, I didn't really understand what you were working on, but you were so enthusiastic about it. He said, you had to succeed, he said. So I said, well, that sounds good, Bernie. So he was retired at the time. And I got a renewal. And later on, that year, I got a call on the phone, somebody asking me, would I be interested in following a management track? Would I be interested in going in that direction? I don't know where this came from, this phone call. I told him absolutely no. I said I wanted to learn all I could about the technology, and that's the way I wanted to do it. And so I always stayed out of that. And then when I went to the university, I had to get involved in management. So go figure. But anyway, I was very interested in doing the imaging work early on. And I decided to do work in a discrete semiconductor ones, not beam scan, but scanned with switches. So imagine that you take out a checkerboard pattern, and then you put switches there instead of the electron beam. So every one of those switches is going to have a slightly different characteristic. Every one of those squares will have a different sensitivity, and there will be feed-throughs in the switch. All of that's going to create tremendous fixed pattern noise, and the image will look terrible in a solid state array. So that's really what I was working on, trying to get rid of the fixed pattern noise. But there's also other types of noise. Anytime you reset a capacitor, you have to reset it through the resistance of the switch, the resistance of the leads. And this resistance gives rise to fluctuations of carriers, and you get what's called Nyquist noise. KTC noise is what we refer to it as. And so if you had like a quarter of a picofarad capacitance, you'd probably get something like a couple hundred electrons RMS noise at room temperature. And that sets the limit to the performance of the dynamic range in imaging arrays. You could store 200,000 electrons, but if 200 electrons RMS is your noise, you have only a 60 dB dynamic range, 1,000 to 1. So this was a serious problem in all imagers at that time. So we tended to solve that problem. There was a lot of people interested in this. Eventually it went into NASA-related satellites. It went into eventually work in the medical area through endoscopy, through intraoral digital photography in the dentist's office. It basically went into the Hubble telescope up there and the James Webb, now it's up there. And the technique was called correlated double sampling. So at the time, basically what I did was I decided that this was important enough that we ought to give papers on it. So we gave papers, and then I stopped working on it for quite a while and worked on other things. But that was the first thing that I started working on. And that was the thing that 50 years later, I was recognized for doing it. Where over 6 billion cameras use it. So there's a lot of history involved in that. And but I worked on an awful lot of other things. You mentioned, what did I work on? I worked on imaging devices. Clearly that was the principle of storage is so fundamental, because you improve your signal to noise by storing the signal. Because what happens is the signal comes in, it fluctuates, the photons fluctuate. So there's inherent background limited imaging performance due to the fluctuation of the photons, but the basic kinds of noise you can try to reduce. That's in the sampling process, in the processing. So it's important to reduce that noise as much as possible. Today there are people working on this that can get down close to single photon imaging. It's pretty incredible. And then this will lead to transmission of signals with single photons eventually. So there is a tremendous future in the area of imaging, the detection of single photons. We are at the point where if we cool these imaging arrays down, we can see single photons coming in. And so it is just quite incredible. And anyway, that was the first thing I worked on. But then after that, I started working on non-volatile memories. This was an extremely interesting area, the idea of storing information in a non-volatile way, like you use that on with your drives, your little small USB drives that you plug in. I started working on this very early on, and did some work on that with people at my company. And this was called MNOS to begin with very thin oxides, less than 20 angstroms. Can you believe it? Now these tunnel oxides that we used to joke about are now used in the conventional devices, down around 10 angstroms or less, equivalent oxide thicknesses. So that was interesting for me to work on non-volatile memories. And I started working on CMOS devices. In 1973, I believe it was, CT Saw, Tom Saw, and colleagues, they worked on CMOS devices and gave a paper at the ISSCC. And they thought that, and what they did was take discrete devices, as I remember, N and P channel devices, put them in a can, and made NAND and NOR circuits and demonstrated how they worked, RS flip-flops, so on. But when I got back from that meeting, I decided I was working with colleagues to try to do if we could integrate it on a single substrate. So we played around doing that. We had a NASA contract to work on that. NASA was interested in CMOS. Industry wasn't interested in it so much, but NASA was interested because they wanted to have radiation-hardened devices in space. And they also wanted low power, extremely low power. And CMOS, you know, I was interviewed 20 years ago by the IEEE Center, I have to tell you that. And the question was asked to me, you know, what do you think CMOS is going to happen to CMOS? This was 1999. And I said, looking ahead, I don't think anything is going to compete with it. Because I said, it has all the right attributes to it. And lo and behold, I went back and looked at that interview that I had done. And I had a laugh at it because it is true. And look at what's happening with CMOS today, vertical integration in it, which your first interviewer did from Berkeley. Chin-Ming.
Yeah, Chin-Ming for FinFET.
I have to laugh, though. I have a story about Chin-Ming, I have to tell you. I shouldn't maybe sell it, but one time we were talking at the DRC meeting, I think it was some meeting, and he said that, you know, I was thinking of, he came back from being a CTO at
TSMC.
TSMC, and he asked me, he says, do you think I ought to take a position as dean at a university? I won't mention the university. It wasn't Berkeley. And I said, no, it's to be avoided, I told him. He later told me, he said, that was the best advice you gave me. He said, but it's true. I mean, you know, I think when a person is really good technically, they can make a great contribution too and enjoy it very much. So Chin-Ming and I laughed at that, about that, I remember. But, you know, I know most of the people I looked at on the list that you've been talking to, and they've just done a wonderful job. And I hope many more come on that list too and talk about their life a little bit. But I worked on CMOS devices quite a bit with my colleagues there. And they were useful in doing, and now also integrating this in with the imaging sensors as well. So we spent a lot of time on that. Later on, I worked on a lot of things, bipolar devices as well. And then when I went to the university, I started working on different things. I'll tell you one thing, in that interview in 1999, I was asked at the end, what do you think is going to be a new technology in the future? And I said at that time that I believe that high power electronics and silicon carbide was going to be a big factor in going to the all electric car. I said that. And I look back at what I said that time, and I'm working on silicon carbide now at Ohio State with my first PhD student. He's a professor here. He was at Lehigh, Anant Agarwal. So I'm so proud of, you know, the work that my students are doing in industry. And anyways, going to university was very, very informative to me because I got a chance to work on so many different things there as well. The thing that was tiring in industry after a while was that you'd start a run in the laboratory and the run would proceed in the lab and you weren't allowed to go in because you'd mess up the technicians. By the time it came out, you forgot why you started it. And there were so many meetings all the time. I figured if I go to a university, I'm going to avoid the meetings. I'm going to avoid these things. And little did I know, when you go to university, you have more meetings. So anyway, my life in the company at Westinghouse was about 20 years. I was there working 1961 to 1981, 20 years. And then I got a chance to go up to Lehigh University as a endowed professorship, the Sherman Fairchild one. Sherman Fairchild gave some money to the school to start a solid state laboratory up there, a solid state building. So they needed to have somebody come up there. And fortunately, I had published enough. You know, in the universities, if you don't publish, you know, you don't get recognized very well. So I tended to publish, and I did it because I wanted to meet people and talk to them at the conferences. And, you know, companies don't like people to necessarily go to conferences, and but the Japanese would come there and they'd open up their notebooks and they'd show you their laboratory notebooks. I mean, it was absolutely incredible to sit there talking to them and sharing information. They just come there. They're so proud of what they was doing. They were doing outstanding work. Outstanding. They took over the MOS lead in the 1980s from us, and we had to regain it again. They really did a great job. And they had such great people there. And I think we ought to get some on there as visionaries too. So anyway, that's the way it was at Westinghouse for 20 years I spent there.
Right, a great story, right? Like, you know, the categorically you addressed the issues with the CMOS imager. By the way, you know, I was program manager in Sematic, and when in the 80s, Japan took over the lead, global leadership in semiconductor, Sematic was established by the DOD to basically consolidate America's strength, and eventually we overcame.
Let me make a comment to you there about this. Do you realize that American industry stayed with NMOS technology for so long, with multiple metallizations, trying everything they could not to use CMOS? And you know, the reason that CMOS wasn't used originally, you will not believe this. You weren't around at the time. It took one extra photo step.
Right.
And you couldn't pack it as well. But then we had things like locusts come along, right, that allowed oxide isolation, that allowed us to pack closer. And we had ion implant. And these things came from universities.
Right. Yeah, I think.
Like, and the FinFET came from a university too, right?
Correct. Yes. Yeah, many of these things, definitely. I still believe that we need to partner with the industries, but at the same time, we should not be losing our edge in free thinking and to come up with the wildest of ideas, because we never know which one is actually going to trigger a new era of technological innovation. You know, it is like, you know, obviously, you know, that my understanding, at least, like, you know, I was in the industry, in TI and in Sematic, before I joined academia, that helps us a lot, like, you know, to be organized, to be to do things in a much more pragmatic way. But we should not be losing our vision, being in the industry, and to work with our freshest minds, the youth, that to really go and try to discover things which are which are, in a sense, like, you know, the out of the blue sky, right?
But you know, Mohammed, you don't get a lot of credit for doing analysis in industry. And I'll tell you, the industry is interested in getting the job done and getting on with the next project. And let's say you as an intellectual, you want to know why this happened. You want to study it. And because you don't want to make the mistake again, you want to improve the technology. But the industry doesn't have the time to do that. They're working on a very fast program.
Right.
That makes a difference, you know, for if you want to do something. That's what I looked at the university. I said, now I can put the lab together. I can try to understand something and move the technology along.
Correct.
But then I didn't have the tools after a while. You don't have the ability to make some of the devices. So you have to really think about how you're going to do this.
Right, exactly. Okay, so Marv, I'm going to actually switch to a little bit lighter portion of our conversation, which we call the rapid fire round. In this part is very popular with our younger audience. We are going to ask you some questions which are going to actually let us know you more up close, okay? You know, we prefer you to respond in one or two words so that, like, it's a rapid fire round. So whenever you're ready, just let me know.
Go ahead.
What are your hobbies?
Well, I like to play jazz piano. I fly fish. And let's see, I play bridge. What else do I like to do now? Magic. I like magic.
Okay, that's very impressive. Fly fishing, so you must like Montana.
Yes, I do. I go to Missoula out there okay. And fish in Montana.
Yeah, okay. Music or movie? Which one you enjoy more?
Well, I like them both, but I would lean much more towards music. I like music. I think something people have said to me one time that people like math and do physics and things like that, like music too, and like to play music. So yeah, I think I like pretty much like to listen to great piano players, you know, like Bud Powell.
Mm-hmm.
Was a great pianist. You know, there was a lot of great pianists, Oscar Peterson, you know, just unbelievable pianists that I love to listen to. So I listen to jazz pianists quite a bit.
Great. What is the book you are reading now?
You know, I'm involved in a book called 5 Days in London by John Lucas. This actually was made into a movie a while back. I think it's called The Darkest Hour a few years back. It didn't get good reviews from the critics, but Gary Oldman, who played Winston Churchill, got the Oscar for his performance.
Right.
It's a story about from May 24th to May 28th, 5 days, which defended democracy against the Nazis. We're having a similar type of problem right now in Ukraine. But at that particular time, Churchill was put in as prime minister because Neville Chamberlain was not able to, he tried to judge Hitler and he judged him incorrectly. And he came back and waved the paper and said, we have peace in our time, but we didn't. And so he was relieved of it. And Churchill was the only one that could satisfy the parties, both parties over there. So Churchill formed the cabinet. And he put on the cabinet all the people really that opposed him. And he had to try to deal with the situation. Do we capitulate like Belgium did and like France did to the Nazis? Do we give up or do we fight on? And he had to fight his cabinet. People in the cabinet were against him.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting to see I don't think the movie did justice. The movie had some intricate things in there, like the king came down and went to his house, which I didn't believe the king would do. And then he had some things where Churchill got on the subway in the movie, you know, and met with people. But he didn't need that to change his mind. And he was a great writer. You know, he wrote the history of Britain. So, you know, I decided to read this book because this fellow is a great historian, went back and looked at all of the letters and put this book together. And it teaches you something to see. It's the research. It's the research that he did in a different field than I work in. But he did a very good research, putting together what people were saying in the cabinet. It was just an incredible read. So you can look at it on a Kindle or you can look at the hard thing, but that's the book I'm reading now, finishing it up.
Great. I will look into it. It sounds like fascinating piece of history. Thank you. Mm-hmm. What is your favorite cuisine?
What is the favorite vacation spot?
No, cuisine, food.
Oh, what cuisine, type of food you like? Cuisine. Well, I have it for different reasons. You know, I like, my mother used to always cook Italian food because she wasn't Italian, but it was something quick. when you got home from work, you could prepare. So she would do that. And I got used to that. But I like French food. And you won't believe why I like French food. Not just because it's great cooking, but they serve it in small quantities.
Correct. That's right.
I don't like the way it's prepared in America, where you have huge quantities that I can't, as I get older, I can't eat all of that food. And what happens is I have it packaged up and it lasts for 2 or 3 days.
Yeah,
so
but
you have it at home. Right, so but I like the French food. It's done. And Indian food I like too. They put it in very small little things. And my wife cooks Indian food too. So I enjoy that, and French food. Those are the foods, so French food, Indian food, and Italian food.
Great.
I shouldn't leave out the Greeks. I do like Greek food too. I have many friends that are Greek.
Greek foods, the Mediterranean foods are really like, you know, the awesome.
Aren't they great? Yeah,
right.
I do.
Right. And the comment that you made about the quantity, and because like, you know, on many occasions that's not preserved, so the food gets wasted. On the other hand, there are many people in the world who actually there's like, you know, they need food. Okay, let's move on.
You know, right now they say they're taking away the food from the hungry and giving it to the starving.
Right. Okay. Any sports you enjoy?
Sports?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, when I was a young, I mentioned to you, I like to play
soccer.
Well, not so much, but football, our American football, tag. Right. And I like to play basketball and baseball. So I did all the sports. You know, when growing up in New York there, you know, you could only kick the can on the street. So you couldn't get out much. I didn't learn to swim until I was close to 20. My mother was scared to send me to swimming because of polio. There was this rumor, I don't know how true, but you know, like FDR went out in the cold water, came back.
Right.
So we were all scared of going out to the swimming pools. So I didn't learn to swim until almost 20 years of age. And it was taught by a Greek boy who took me out in the lake around Michigan, and I swam across the lake, and he told me, you just have to, don't get excited, just dog paddle. And he showed me how a dog paddles. And so I just started that way, and eventually I learned how to swim. I had never swam before that time. I was scared, actually, of the water.
All right. Okay, last question from this segment. What is your favorite travel spot?
Well, you know, we've traveled around the world a little bit, but we have the one I would say in the United States is Kiawah Island down in South Carolina. They have a long beach down there, about 10 miles, and I used to like to get out and run it in the morning. So that made it great. And then they had crabs down there and seafood. So I like that place down there. And I haven't been down there in a while, the pandemic. I haven't traveled much, except that I went out to Las Vegas recently.
Okay, so now we are in the last portion of our conversation. We will be looking into the future through your perspective. So from that segment, my first question is, what is your thought about the electronics in the future?
Well, you know, I was listening to the president the other day, and the president's visited Samsung. And he made the comment over there that electronics is going to be the future, basically. And the work that you're doing over here, he said, is going to be like a leadership role. It is the future. Electronics is the future. If you think of everything that we do today, we would not be able to record social justice on these cameras that we're doing now with George Floyd, you know.
Right.
We would not be able to see that and have a person have the ability to record that, the picture and the sounds. We would not see what's happening in the Ukraine. We would not see what's happening in deep space, in the beginning of the origin of the universe. So we would not be able to see these things. And at the same time, we would not have the medical advances that we have today. A tremendous medical advantages due to electronics. I can't see anything but the future. And the electric car, if we go electric, if we keep pushing this direction, electronics is going to play a major role. It is already like 25% in the cars, the electronics.
Right.
in right. terms of cost. So I think, you know, the one is a great future. Yeah.
One of the things about, like, you know, the camera technology is, like, you know, the it is bringing our attention to the different kind of social injustices. It is right. also bringing us connected to our, you know, the families and friends. Like, you know, the irrespective of 1,000 miles away, we can still connect and can communicate, like, you know, more interactively. And just imagine the last 2 years of pandemic. Who thought that, or who knew, and that in the 21st century, the whole world will stall, right? And we could connect through those camera technology with each other. Obviously, like, you know, that's a huge contribution that you have made. My next question.
You see, yeah, go ahead. I'll just interrupt for a second, yes, Mohammed. You had an interview with
Eric Fossum.
With Eric, yeah. And I actually pulled that up to just take a look at it, because I'm very familiar with the work that he's done over the years. I visited him as a graduate student when he was at Yale and talked to TP and Barker and all the people in the lab. I gave some photo masks up there when I was at Lehigh to Yale people.
Right.
And I've stayed connected with Eric over the years. And, you know, he is really a visionary. He deserves everything that he's gotten, and a wonderful person. And he says what he thinks. And I like that very much. And he's very clear about everything. And so I knew him when he went out to JP, when he was at, when he went to JPL. He was right, there at right. JPL. I knew him when he was out there. And he's just done a great job. And now he's up at Dartmouth. And he's doing a good job up there with the faculty, and especially with the single photon counting work that he's been doing.
Correct. Correct.
Yeah.
Okay. My next question, is there anything that strikes your mind which can be better today? It doesn't necessarily need to be a technological one or technical one.
Which can be better than what it is today?
Yes.
Well, so certainly we have to, as a world, come together a little bit and try to understand what our real problems are. Our real problems are that we are seeing democracy under attack around the world. It has a tremendous impact on people. And the young people growing up are growing up in this kind of a world. And I don't know how to deal with this myself, but it's a big, big, big problem. But I do think being able to record what's going on, you know, with our cameras and things, and the electronics, you know, that we have are going to help a lot. But that is a big problem. And then, of course, the climate change, and basically these things are interacting with one another. We just have to, we have to get under a 1.5 degrees in the next 10 years. We're going to have severe problems. Our coastlines will basically disappear under high flooding. And you already see that in like Bangladesh and countries like that. And I know you're familiar with that.
Right. There, right. There. You know, obviously, so, obviously.
Yeah. So, you know, it's not related in a direct way to electronics, but perhaps electronics can be a way of controlling climate change. I don't know what that will be right now, but there's been some speculation on how we might right. approach that.
Right. I think, like, you know, the environmental precision monitoring is something, you know, that I have worked extensively, and, like, you know, we were actually awarded this the Consumer Electronics Show the back in 2021 the Best Innovation Award, because we came up with an idea of a wearable patch for the marine species which can monitor the aqua environment, which is a very significant resource for our Earth. And there are many things going on, and I think, like, you know, the electronics can actually do a lot. And, you know, I agree with Mark Lundstrom. He always says that we have just scratched the surface of the CMOS electronics. We are turning the page for this next phase. It's not phasing out. We are just going for the next phase. Okay.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that. Mark.
Right, right. So my next question, can you actually imagine an application that you would love to see, but that does not exist today?
Oh. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if there's an application that doesn't exist today that trying to think now. We have all the technology to address an application today. You know, we have low power, high speed, we have high power. I mean, there isn't anything right now that I feel we can't address. We may not be able to be doing it optimally. So, you know, from a systems point of view, I think we can address most of the needs we have. Of course, obviously, one of the overriding things is the pandemic that we're having. And although people say there's only 7 million people in the world that are dying from it, that's 7 million too many. And, you know, basically what we need to do is perhaps come up with a way to deal with handling these kinds of pandemics. And maybe we can do it through electronics, for example. Maybe there's a way to do that. You know, basically what's happening with the way that they're able to generate the vaccines so quickly, you know, I think electronics has played a role in this process. So maybe it's possible that we can have sensors that we can wear, like you mentioned, wearable electronics. Maybe we can have sensors that would sense the environment and sense ourselves and be able to alert us, so to speak. You know, like the Apple Watches do, able to alert us to that we're having a problem. You know, in this area and I think China has gone in this direction a little bit with the mainland China with the idea of recording where you are, you know, and although that has some downsides, as you all know.
The previous issues.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Surveillance.
So I don't know, that it's a good question, and it's something that really requires some thought as to, and Bill Gates tends to fund these kinds of things, the Gates Foundation. Right. If you put in some spectacular thought, you know, maybe you can get some money from the Gates Foundation. But I don't have any spectacular thoughts at this point, except world problems, I think, are on my mind all the time. We sit and look at the news and we're just so feeling so bad about what's happening in the world, you know, the climate and the war. Mm-hmm. And the disease and the loss of food, now with the Ukraine not able to supply through their seaports, you know, it's just going to be a terrible thing. I don't think many people realize how bad it is. My maternal grandmother comes from Kudilova, who is in the Ukraine and in that area, and it used to be in the Hungary, but that climate over in Europe keeps changing all the time.
Correct.
It keeps changing. It used to be called Kudilova. And now it's called Hoyo is what it was called when it was Hungary. And now it's called Kudilova. So the cities move around on the bound. I'm sure in your area, there's been some change as well.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. Okay. So my last question from our conversation, and that is your one piece of suggestion for the younger generation.
Well, you know, I thought a little bit about that in a previous kind of talk. I got an award from the Consumer Society. And when I went out to accept it in the LA area, my wife was with me. They asked me to give a talk at lunchtime to young people about what I would recommend that they do, you know. And I've always said talk is cheap. You know, you hear people give commencement talks and so on like that. But I think the one thing that's made a difference for me is to basically have a mentor.
Right.
So in other words, when you go out and start working, you should try to find somebody that you really admire and see if that person would be able to help you and mentor you.
Mm-hmm.
And I did find that person, you know, it was a Greek person. He's mm-hmm. from Greece. And he knew about semiconductors, and all I had was a background in vacuum tubes.
And right,
And he was able to give me an idea of how transistors worked and how you designed with transistors. Because, you know, in vacuum tubes, you don't have quite the loading effects that you do in
Correct.
Transistors. And so he was able to give me some ideas on how to approach the problem. And in return for that, I typed up two of his books, his chapters of his books. So
right.
I was a pretty good typist. And so I was able to give that. And meanwhile, his wife cooked Greek meals for me at night. I was single at the time. So.
Right.
So anyway, I would say try to find a mentor or and they try to do this at the university here. Sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes it works. The department head has said to me when I came out here to OSU, you know, can you mentor this person? Can you help this person? And things like that. So it was, I think it's a good advice. So when you join a university, if you're at a university, find somebody that you really admire and hope that, you know, he can give you or she can give you some good suggestions and kind of help out. So I think a mentorship is really important.
So thank you so much, Marv. It was a very fascinating, engaging, and insightful. And more importantly, as I said, I would like to emphasize the word on authentic conversation with you. It is a fascinating life story. And we look forward to actually see more of your contributions coming to the aid of, you know, that our world is facing certain kind of crisis. At the same time, we have made many technological advances, and you have made significant contributions to that. Thank you so much for that.
Well, Mohammed, I think you're all set for this new world now that's coming forward. And really, I think you're the kind of person that has to take a leadership role and move ahead. You know, I may have had a leadership role for a while, but we have to pass the baton, as we say, along. And it's the people like yourself, younger generation, to take the lead now. And don't give up. Don't give up hope.
Sure.
Stay committed to doing the work that you're doing. And that'll make a difference then.
Thank you for attending this IEEE EDS-sponsored podcast. To listen to other EDS podcasts, as well as benefits and resources EDS offers, please go to the website eds.ieee.org. Thank you for listening.